Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. It's Peter Schiff, and welcome to another episode of Wall Street Unspun, where we try to take all of the news of the week and unspin it, so you can get the truth instead of Wall Street and the media's distorted version of reality. Anyway, I do this show every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, on both shortwave radio at 5.07 megahertz, and on my website at www.europac.net, EUROPAC.net. Well, a lot of action. Again, you know, every week there's a lot of stuff going on. The last couple of days, the Dow is up 500 points or something like that. It was up over 300 today, 200 yesterday. And, of course, the reaction to most on the financial media is, aha, this is it. This is the turnaround. The problems are solved. We're back on track. The bull market is in gear. And, you know, I think that there's a good chance that, we're in a bear market right now, at least even in dollars. I mean, we've certainly been in a bear market since 2000 in terms of every other currency on the planet, practically, and in terms of any commodity on the planet, and certainly in the U.S. versus any other stock market in any other country, people have lost a lot of wealth holding U.S. stocks since the year 2000. But I think even in nominal terms, the Dow could be going down, because I think the problems are really at a head right now. There are just tremendous, tremendous problems underlying our financial institutions, our banking institutions, the brokerage firms. And I think America's days of borrowing money and spending it are coming to an end. And that's going to undermine the very foundation of this phony economy that we've been living with. And I think it's all going to be crumbling beneath our feet here. And so I think the stock market, even in dollar terms, is going to be going down. And, you know, the type of action that we had today, these big, violent moves up, you know, this is more characteristic of a bear market than a bull market. You know, the bear market likes to call attention to the fact that it's going up. It likes to make a dramatic statement to give people hope. You know, the bull market climbs a wall of worry, and the bear market slides a slope of hope. And when you have 300-point up days, that gives people hope. People think about these days. And then what happens is, as the bear market goes down, this 300-point up day is gradually given up, and the market makes new lows. And then all of a sudden, there's another big up day, and that gives more false hope. This is, I think, still a bear market. I think there's a lot of problems for these financials and the entire economy. You know, there was this article in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was on Monday, and I'm going to be writing a commentary about part of this, and I think this really epitomizes, you know, what's been going on in our economy and in this country. And maybe this is an extreme example, but I don't think it's atypical. Anyway, this article in the Wall Street Journal was talking about Citigroup and some of the mortgages that Citigroup held. And one of them was a mortgage to a couple, and they talked about the woman, but it was a married couple out in California. And this couple bought a house in 1985, so about 22 years ago. And they paid $105,000 for this house. $105,000. It's a blue-collar couple. They had pretty, you know, blue-collar type jobs. And, you know, they probably put a 20% down payment on the thing when they bought it, and, you know, got a 30-year fixed-rate loan when they first started off. Well, here we're 22 years into the loan, right? 22 years ago, she bought this house. Now, if things had gone normally, they would have 8 years left on the mortgage. the mortgage payments are probably $550, $600 a month. And they probably have maybe $40,000 left on this 30-year mortgage. And they're in their 50s. So, you know, in about, 8 years, when they're, you know, just in their early 60s, they would have paid off their mortgage. And now they'd have a house that they'd own without any debt on it. And maybe they could retire into their, you know, their retirement years with a fully paid-up house. Well, it turns out that right now, the couple is having trouble making their mortgage payments, and they're in jeopardy of losing their house. Now, they're still both employed, although they said one of them, the woman, maybe was partially disabled now, and her income wasn't as high as it used to be. Not that they ever had a high income. And they have an adjustable rate mortgage now, and it hasn't even reset. It's at 8% right now. It's set to but it's going to rise sharply, I think, next year, but they're already behind the payments. But here's the shocker. The mortgage on this house is $625,000. 22 years after they bought it, they owe $625,000. That's six times what they paid for the house. So instead of being almost paid off and owning the house free and clear after 22 years of home ownership, they have no equity. They have negative equity. They have $600,000 in debt on this house that they've owned for 22 years. I mean, and now the couple has refinanced five times since the year 2000. Now, I don't know if they borrowed any money against the house prior to the year 2000. I know it wasn't really fashionable until 2000. But let's assume they borrowed it all since 2000. That means in the last 7 years, they've borrowed $500,000 and spent every last penny because they don't have the money. They don't have any other assets. They're broke. They can't make their payments. Now, it did mention that, you know, she had a white Lexus, which she bought the other, she used some of the money from her last refi to pay off the car loan on her Lexus that she had just bought. But here's this couple, and, you know, their combined household income is probably $60,000, $70,000 is what I'm guessing, because they said on their last mortgage, all they had to do to get it was to claim that they earned $100,000 a year, which means if they said they had to claim it, they probably earn less than that. And looking by the job descriptions, they probably don't earn $100,000 a year. So this couple has borrowed, what, $500,000 over the last 7 years. What is that, about $80,000 a year that they borrowed and spent? Now, it's no wonder, right? Everybody talks about the American consumer, the heroic consumer, that nothing fazes him, not high oil prices, not a falling stock market, not a they just go out and spend. Well, here's why. Because they're borrowing all this money and spending it. Well, who knows what they bought on, you know, furniture, on television sets, on automobiles. Maybe they took some vacations. Maybe they bought some nice clothes. Maybe they went to restaurants. I don't know what they did with the money. But they sure as hell didn't invest it. They spent it all. Well, maybe they spent some of it remodeling the house. I don't know. Maybe they put new bathrooms in, and maybe they got some Viking appliances in there. I don't know. But all this money was borrowed and spent. No wonder we've had all this so-called economic growth based on consumer spending. When here you have a couple, a blue-collar couple, is able to borrow $500,000 in the last 5 years and spend every penny. You know, no wonder. But now what are the consequences? What are the consequences of what they've done? Now, of course, in the article, they're trying to make you feel sorry for this couple because they're about to lose their home. Now, of course, they're not losing any money, right? I mean, they only paid, let's say, you know, whatever they paid for the house. I mean, they extracted $500,000 in the last 7 years. I mean, they made a fortune on that house. Now, of course, they're in the poorhouse because they blew all their money. But certainly over the last 7 or 8 years, they spent a lot more than they ever put into that house. The real losers, of course, are Citibank and their shareholders who are sitting on a $625,000 mortgage. The question is, when they stop making their payments, what are they going to get for this house when they sell it? I bet they'd be lucky to get $300,000 for this house, which would still be triple what they paid for it 22 years ago. But it's not going to be half of what this mortgage is worth. So these are going to be serious losses. And if you think about this greater fool theory, they refinanced this mortgage five times. That means everybody else who lent her money got repaid. But how did they get repaid? Because she was able to get a bigger mortgage from another lender. So what happens is you keep refinancing, you keep borrowing more money, and when you can't make your payments, you go find somebody else to loan you even more money. And that's what they were doing every 5 years, you know, and they paid a lot of the money, the $500,000 that they borrowed. Every time they refinanced, they had fees and they had prepayment penalties, but they paid them because that's how desperate they were for more money to go out and buy more things, like a Lexus. Like, you know, it's not like she didn't even use the money to buy a domestic product. We borrowed money to go buy a Japanese car and, you know, and a fancy car, you know, not an economy car. No, she bought a Lexus, top of the line. You know, and so eventually we ran out of a greater fools, right, to continue to roll over this paper. And now Citicorp is the one left holding the bag. And now we're going to find out, of course, what the house is really worth. Because, of course, all these appraisals and all these refinances were based on phony numbers because they never sold the house. They were all figuring out, hey, what do we think this house is worth? And they all assigned some high value. I'm sure when she refinanced last year and borrowed that $625,000, I'm sure they had an appraisal that said $750,000 or $800,000. Who knows what the appraisal said? But, you know, it was meaningless because it wasn't based on real transactions. It was fantasy. The real transaction is going to be when they go to sell this thing in foreclosure. That's the same thing with all these mark-to-markets, all these hedge funds, and all these people that own all kinds of esoteric, you know, structured investment vehicles. And every month or every year, they get statements from their hedge fund managers showing all their gains. These gains are just as real as these phony appraisals. You know, what we're gonna find out over the next few years is what these things are really worth when people actually have to sell them. You know, when you don't have to sell them, you can pretend they're worth anything. You know, and of course, there's a big incentive for people to pretend these things have value because they get compensated based on what they tell you things are worth, not based on what they're really worth. And you know, that's what our whole economy is now. It's you know, as long as the government says there's no inflation, then there's no inflation. As long as the government says we're not in a recession, we're not in a recession. I have these debates all the time now on this Fox News, and people are saying, well, you know, I don't really think there's going to be a recession coming. We're in a recession. I mean, these people are so clueless. The recession is here. The only reason they think there's no recession is because the government is claiming there's no recession based on these phony numbers. Just like the government is telling us there's no inflation. And the other people on Wall Street believe it. They believe there's no inflation. You know, there was a guy on Fox I was debating with today talking about recession. And, you know, he said, of course, there's not a recession. But he said a real recession is when the public thinks there's a recession. You know, not necessarily what the numbers are, but he said if the public thinks there's a recession, then there really is one. Of course, the public does think there's a recession. He missed that point. You know, all the surveys that have come out, you know, where they poll people and they say, what do you think the economy, how do you think the economy is? You know, the majority of people think we're in a recession because we are. Most people just say, well, this is a disconnect. And people just don't understand how great the economy is. They're not looking at these government numbers. Anyway, I know we've got some calls already in the queue, but the number to call if you have any questions or comments is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Well, the bottom line on this couple, I mean, obviously I don't think most people have borrowed as much money. I mean, I hope that this is not a typical, I mean, an example. It maybe is an extreme example, but I have a feeling that they're not unique, that it's a very normal thing that people have borrowed and spent a lot of money against their houses and bought a lot of things. But the bottom line is we've had this phony economy, consumer credit economy, and it's going to collapse because the people who have been lending us money aren't going to do it anymore because now they're realizing that we're not good for it. We can't pay it back. You know, when I mentioned this consumer credit collapse coming on Fox, people jumped on me by saying, well, no, you're predicting the end of capitalism, and if we don't have credit, we don't have capitalism. See, these people are confused. There's not going to be an end to business credit. Entrepreneurs are still going to be able to borrow money. People are still going to be able to borrow money for capital investments. There's nothing wrong with that. What's going to end is people borrowing money to buy television sets. You know, that never should have happened in the first place. I mean, that's not part of capitalism. That's negative. I mean, I wrote a lot about this in my book, Crash Proof. And if you haven't already read that book, I definitely suggest you go pick up a copy. I wrote a lot about this in my book. And by the way, I noticed a lot of people since my last episode, my last show, went on and put on reviews. I think I've got about 10 more reviews, or 12 more reviews, since last week. And I'm sure that's in response, to the comments I made last week about a couple of negative reviews that were on there. And I asked some people to write some positive reviews. And so now we've got those two negative reviews, you know, way out, and you know, no one's going to notice them now. So I thank everybody for that, everybody who wrote a positive review. And if you haven't written your five-star review, you know, go up on Amazon and tell everybody how much you like it. I'd like to see how many reviews we can get on there. Maybe it'll help us sell more books if people see that it's been reviewed by quite a few people. Plus, the more five-star reviews we have on there, if you know, any more of Mike Norman's relatives want to go up there and put a one-star review, it'll be evened out. So there'll be a lot of five stars to counter it, and it'll keep the high rating. But anyway, just a little bit more, and I'll go to the calls in a minute on the credit. So consumer credit is a bad thing because it credit is limited. I mean, there's not an unlimited amount of savings. And so if people borrow money to buy TVs, well, there's less money available for somebody to make a capital investment. But think about it this way. I mean, if you're loaning money, who do you want to loan money to? Let's say an entrepreneur comes to me and says, can you loan me $5,000? I say, well, what are you going to do with it? Well, I'm going to buy a new piece of equipment for my business that's going to increase my efficiency. As a result, I'm going to be able to increase my profits by, you know, a couple of $1,000s per year. And that extra profits, then I'll be able to pay you back the money that you lend me. And I said, well, that sounds pretty good. I said, yeah, and I'm willing to secure the loan with the assets of my business. Oh, so you got collateral, and you're going to take the money I loan you and use it to improve your efficiency of your business and generate greater income, and then you're going to use that greater income to pay me back. That makes sense. Okay, I'm going to make you a loan. Here's how consumer credit, someone comes to me and says, hey, Peter, can you lend me $5,000? What are you going to do with that money? Well, I thought I'd take a vacation and buy me a plasma TV. Well, you're going to take the money and take a vacation? Yeah. I mean, I want to go to the Bahamas and, you know, I need some cash. You know, I might want to, you know, go deep sea fishing and, you know, plus when I get back, I want to have a big screen TV because I want to play movies that I took on my camcorder. Like, well, wait a minute. Well, why do you need to borrow the money to take the vacation? Can't you just take a vacation on your savings? Well, no, I don't have any savings. I mean, I can't afford the vacation. That's why I want you to lend me the money. Well, if I lend you this money, how are you going to pay me back? Well, I'm just going to work harder in the future. But then why don't you do that now? Why don't you just work harder now and save up the money? You know, what I'm getting at is if someone can't afford a television set or to take a vacation, how are they going to afford to pay me back? They're not acquiring an asset that's going to produce any income. They're just, you know, asking to borrow money to spend it, and now they've got to pay me back plus interest. I mean, why would you want to loan money to somebody under those circumstances? There's a very good chance that they're not going to be able to pay you back. I mean, if they couldn't save up to $5,000 for the vacation, how are they going to save up to $5,000 plus interest to pay you back for your loan? This is the sham of consumer credit, and it's going to end. And Americans are going to have a very difficult time in the future borrowing money to consume anything. And in the long run, that's a very good thing. But in the short run, that is going to topple our phony economy, which is completely based on the ability of Americans to buy things they can't afford with money they don't have. Anyway, let's quickly take the call. The first caller is from New York, Fan Ying. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter. I like what you're doing, and finally got my account move over and invested, so I'm feeling really, really good, been really good for a long time. Do you have anything about like agricultural-based stocks around the world that I'm looking at? I know that like
buying this one agricultural finance company in New Zealand, which recently made a new 52-week high. It's been one of our best performers. We've got some other companies. You know, we do a lot of investing in Australia, New Zealand, where there is agriculture, and you know, we've got some agricultural names in Asia and some ETFs that we've been buying in London that are specific pays on agricultural commodities. So if you want to get into specific stock ideas and specific recommendations, the best thing is contact whichever of my brokers you're working with at Euro Pacific Capital, and they will talk to you about specific investments.
Right, yeah, I'm going to do that. And why would the Middle East or foreign investors, with their appreciated currencies, will want to sink in money to an economy that's sinking?
Well, I think they're making some bad investments, you know, when it comes to their big investment in Citibank, and I'm going to talk to that, or Citigroup, after the break, you know, with Abu Dhabi coming in and buying, you know, a 7.5% stake by buying a convertible preferred with an 11% coupon in Citicorp. I mean, I think that they're doing the right thing when they buy up these natural resource companies, which is what they're mainly focused on. But I think they should stay clear of the financials. I think they can buy them a lot cheaper if they just wait. But, you know, ultimately, and this is the big problem, this is the consequence of years and years of living beyond our means and borrowing money from the rest of the world to consume, is our bankers are going to cash in all these IOUs for our stuff. They're going to buy our assets out from under us. And there are a lot of great American companies. You know, you've got Procter & Gamble, and, you know, you've got Gillette, and you've got Caterpillar, and there's all kinds of, you know, 3M, and, you know, I can go on and on with some quality companies that are probably going to be owned by foreigners right down to the paperclips. And it's unfortunate that these once great American assets are going to be owned by foreigners because we basically mortgaged our country to consume. This was a financial disaster. While our academics and while everyone on Wall Street was patting us on the back, you know, and remember what we did. What did we do? The minute the Iraqis or whoever it was, not the Iraqis, the Saudis and bin Laden, when they attacked on 9/11, and it went out and you know, destroyed the trade centers. George Bush, that very week, was on television urging Americans to go out and shop, go out and buy a new car, whatever you do, keep spending money. I mean, you know, go back to World War II. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, did the president go out and ask Americans to go out and spend money? No, they asked them to do the opposite. They asked them to buy war bonds. They asked Americans to sacrifice. If they weren't joining up and fighting, everybody was asked to sacrifice at home. We were rationing things. We were not spending. We were freeing up resources. We were fighting a war. We were making sacrifices. But the exact opposite. President Bush said, go out and buy some new clothes. Take a vacation. Buy a new car. Fix up your kitchen. I mean, what kind of sacrifice is that? I mean, this is insane what we've been doing, and now we're going to pay the price for that. We bankrupted ourselves as a nation. We spent ourselves into bankruptcy, and it's a massive shame. And, you know, I was criticized. I didn't wait till yesterday. I've been criticizing this process all along. Well, I could see where we were going. And now it's finally coming to the end game where all the ducks are lined up, and this whole thing is going to fall apart. But anyway, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Glad to have you on board as a client. Hey, let's take a quick commercial break, and we'll come back for the rest of the calls and more of the program.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Hi, Peter. I am back. And again, the number to call if you want to participate in the program, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And let me go back to the phones. I've got Leonard from Arizona.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
I'm 30% metals, 30% utilities and energy, and 40% currencies. I was wondering if, in your opinion, do I need to be more diversified, or am I...
get rich with income from your investments right now? Are you getting income?
Well, most of it's with Euro Capital, so I am getting a lot of dividend income.
Yeah, but it depends. What were your percentages again?
30% metals, 30% energy and utilities, and 40% currencies.
Well, currencies mean just currencies, or are you on foreign stocks?
No, just the actual currencies are just at EverBank. They're just CDs.
Yeah, well, I think number one, I think you should have more money invested in dividend-paying foreign stocks rather than just holding currencies. And I'm not a big fan of the EverBank CDs. Not that I have anything against the EverBank guys. I think they're good guys down there at EverBank. But the problem is, it's a bank. I'm very negative on the U.S. banking system. EverBank is very heavily into mortgages. They're heavy in the real estate market. These foreign currency CDs are a small part of their overall business. And I think there's risk there. I don't know what the risk is. I don't know, what happens if EverBank goes under. Their credit rating is not that high relative to, you could go and buy. You can buy the same currencies you're buying at EverBank. You can buy government bonds, from Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, and get a higher rate on your government bonds than EverBank is paying you on your CDs, but get a AAA-rated credit rating and not have to worry about bankruptcy. Now, the thing that Everbank says is, well, your account is FDIC insured. Well, big deal. I mean, who knows? I mean, what good that insurance is. And even if it pays off, the most it'll give you is $100,000. Well, what if your CD is worth $1 million when Everbank goes under? You know, and you only get $100,000. That's not, you lose 90% of your money. You know, and people think, well, I don't have $1 million there. I only have $50,000. Well, how do you know what those CDs are going to be worth if the dollar collapses? A $50,000 CD could be worth $1 million. You don't know. So what I would do is I would take the money out of Everbank and, you know, and send it over here and get it into some foreign asset, and don't just be a creditor of Everbank. Because that's basically what Everbank does is they basically say, we agree to pay you, you know, let's say Australian dollars when your CD matures, and we'll give you interest. But it's just a contract between you and Everbank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so you're just the counterparty is Everbank. And, I just don't think there's too many problems in the banking system for people who are worried about the U.S. dollar to entrust their money with an American bank. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Do you think I'm too much exposed to the metals?
Oh, no. I mean, I have more percentage in metals than you do. It just depends. I mean, it's risky. It depends on how risky, how you want to be. You know, it's a personal decision. You know, do you want to be more aggressive or do you want to be more conservative? So you got to figure that out for yourself. But if you say, well, I don't want to be that aggressive, well, then you do have too much in metals. But if you're saying, no, I want to be very speculative, well, then maybe you don't. It depends on what your real objective is with the account. But you should discuss that, you know, again, with the broker. But what I would do is I think you should take those CDs at Everbank. Now, what you can do if you get out of those CDs at Everbank, don't have Everbank convert the currencies back to dollars. You can take those foreign currencies. Say you have an Australian dollar CD and you tell Everbank, I want to bust my CD or the CD matures. You can have Everbank wire those Australian dollars directly to your Euro Pacific Capital account. That way you won't have to pay Everbank. I think they charge 0.75% to convert your Australian dollars back to U.S. dollars. We only charge like 0.1%, so a fraction of the cost. So basically you can save a lot of money if you just send your Australian dollars here. And if you end up buying Australian government bonds or an Australian stock, we don't have to convert it back to U.S. dollars at all, in which case you won't have any costs on the currency.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Peter.
All right, great. Thank you for the call. Now, also just a comment, too, on this buyout. You know, Abu Dhabi, Sovereign Wealth Fund, you know, buying 7.5% of Citigroup, you know, everybody is treating this as if it were good news. You know, it's not good news. I mean, this, first of all, it shows you that Citigroup was in trouble, and they had to go to Abu Dhabi for the money. They couldn't go to anyone in America because we don't have the money. Right? The money is foreign. That's where all the savings are, and the investment capital. It's in other countries. That's a sad state. And, of course, they didn't give us this money. They bought 7.5% of this company, and the other shareholders are obligated to pay an 11% coupon to these guys. That's a huge yield. That's more than junk bonds are paying. And it's 11% in dividends, which means it's not even tax deductible on the income statement, assuming Citi actually had any income, which they don't now. They have losses. But, and, you know, and people think, oh, the stock has to go up for them to make money. No, they make 11% right now. And you know what? If the stock goes down, they get to renegotiate the exercise price, the strike price, on the preferred. So, I mean, this is basically an example of foreigners coming in and buying up our assets. And, you know, right now it's 7% of Citigroup. Who knows? By the time it's over, they might own 100% of the company. And they might own 100% of a lot of other companies. You know, this is nothing to be excited about. You know, everybody thinks this is great. Foreigners are coming in here and buying our real estate. Foreigners are coming in here and buying our stocks. This is not a good thing. This, you know, someone from Canada came down and bought the boat in the slip next to mine, you know, this is not a good thing that a Canadian came down here and bought a boat from an American, because that boat used to be owned by an American, and probably if the Canadian hadn't been able to come in here, another American would have bought that boat. But you know what? He couldn't afford it because a Canadian came down and paid more than he was able to afford. You know, when you lose your assets or things that you own to foreigners, it is not a good thing. It's a sign of a nation in decline. It's not foreigners investing in America. It's foreigners buying up America. Yeah, I guess if foreigners came in here with capital and built a factory here, I guess that would be an investment in America, and there are companies that do that. But when a company just comes up and buys an existing asset, that's not investing in America. That's buying up America. Anyway, let's go to another call from Arizona. Mike, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, Peter, thank you. Sam, I want to get your take on the Canadian dollar. It seems like in the last 2 weeks it, you know, it fell about 6-7%, which was rather sudden, I think.
Yeah, well, remember, the Canadian dollar had a stellar increase. It went all the way up to $1.10 very quickly. And so it almost went from 90 cents to $1.10 in like a month. And so the fact that it pulled back to a dollar even was not something that was, you know, very weird to have happened. I mean, it seems like a very natural thing to happen. And right now the currency is back up at around $1.02. But I think the key thing is that it seems like the support is now a dollar parity with the U.S. dollar. And I think that we're going to drift back up towards the $1.10 level again, and then we'll see if we take it out. But, I expect to see the Canadian dollar continue to make new highs. I mean, the New Zealand dollar was up 2.25% today, a big move in the New Zealand dollar. Some of these currencies have been pretty volatile lately in Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. But, I mean, the trend is up, you know, and there's going to be volatility, but, you know, it should be in an upward direction.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And let me go to Barry in Los Angeles.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I wondered when you think we're going to start seeing the long-term yields go up on the bonds issued by the Treasury as a result of the declining currency and the sheer debt we have. It just seems odd that the 10-year has stayed so low and seems to be going lower.
Yeah, I don't know when this is going to happen. Because, I mean, it should have happened already. I mean, it's surprising to me that 10-year yields are still as low as they are, you know. And I don't know when it's going to happen, but I can tell you this, that interest rates are going up right now for everybody except the U.S. Treasury. I mean, look, I just mentioned Citigroup had to pay 11% to borrow money from Abu Dhabi. I mean, that's a lot more than they would have had to, you know, pay to borrow money a year or two ago. And everybody, I think people are seeing, you know, jumbo mortgages are going up and junk bond yields are going up and, you know, all sorts of credit is getting more expensive for everybody but the U.S. government. And I'm not really sure, you know, why that is, I mean, what the factors are that are involved, of whether it's hedge funds or foreign central banks or the Fed itself, or, you know, what is it that is causing the yields on the 10-year and the, you know, the 30-year to be, you know, lower than what I know the rate of inflation to be. And it doesn't make any sense for somebody to loan me money when I'm gonna pay them back less than they loan me. So I don't know. I mean, eventually it's going to happen. I think that is the biggest bubble still left yet to burst, is the bubble in the Treasury market.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's some shenanigans going on that's causing that. Either the Fed somehow is manipulating it in a way we don't see, or
manipulating it, they'd be buying it. They would be going out and buying Treasuries. They'd be printing money or creating money and buying Treasuries.
Are they allowed
to? I mean, the money supply is growing, or, you know, maybe they're doing it in some offshore accounts, and we don't know who it is, but I don't know. But it makes no sense, and I don't know who is buying. I mean, I can't imagine anyone in their right mind, any private investor, buying, taking a look at a U.S. government bond and saying, hey, this looks pretty good. I'll buy this 30-year bond at 4%. And, you know, if so many people are negative on the dollar, how can they not be negative on our treasuries? Because treasuries are worse than dollars. Because if the dollar is falling, all treasuries are is obligations for dollars in the future. And so if you don't like the dollar, treasuries are even worse.
So it
doesn't make any sense that the dollar should be going down, but treasuries, which are nothing but IOU dollars, that they should be going up. Makes no sense.
Is it possible that what's going on is they're just issuing, pardon me, less 10-year notes, and they're issuing more to short end?
Well, I mean, I know they're still issuing quite a few. There's a lot of them out there, and they're still borrowing, you know, borrowing at the long run. But yeah, the government, I mean, that's one thing that the government has been doing, is they have been relying on short-term financing, and I mentioned that in my book, in Crash Proof, about how the United States Treasury has committed Americans to the mother of all adjustable-rate mortgages, because our national debt is basically an adjustable-rate mortgage.
Okay, well, I appreciate your comments on that, Peter.
Okay, well, appreciate your call. Are you a client yet?
No, not yet, but I have bought 10 of your books.
Oh, are you giving them away, or?
Yeah, gave them away, and, you know, just kept one or two for me and others.
Well, that's good. You know, they make good Christmas presents. I don't know if you can stuff them in a stocking. They're probably a little too thick, but you can certainly
supporting Ron Paul, and I hope you'll continue to support him because he's the only one who has any economic sense as a presidential candidate.
That's for sure. The rest of them are completely clueless. You probably have to flunk a test on basic economics to run for president, or even have an elected office.
Well, I think he has a chance now because he's it's sort of a perfect storm for a guy who has financial sense. We may head into a disaster just at the right time for him.
The primaries are coming up pretty soon, so we'll see what happens. It'd be real interesting, but I'll definitely be pulling for him and voting for him and, you know, giving him some support where I can.
All right, terrific. Well, thanks again for your good work.
Okay, thanks for the call. And let's take a call from Mark in Iowa.
I was wondering, today the price per barrel of oil went down by about $4, which is a lot for one day.
Yeah, but it's still above 90.
Right, but it dropped yesterday quite a bit, and then today it was down another $4. But the funny thing is all of the oil stocks were up about 2%, and I've never seen where you have oil going down $4 a barrel, and then you got the stock.
Remember, when oil was going up, a lot of these oil stocks were going down. I mean, what's been happening recently is oil stocks have been trading more with the stock market, not with the price of oil. So if the stock market is up, oil stocks are up. If the stock market is down, oil stocks are down. You know, what oil is doing really doesn't matter. Now, if you get a day where stocks are up big and oil is up big, then you get a big, big jump in oil stocks. But in general, the oil stocks are doing what the stock market does and not what the price of oil does.
I'm also wondering, when we see like today, Fannie and Freddie both were up 10-11%, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Are these hedge...
Well, it's short covering. You know, when you have these bear market rallies, you get a lot of short covering. And when shorts cover, they cover at the market. They don't play around with limit orders. They just, if they want to cover, they just say buy. And when you get short covering rallies, they're very sharp, and it looks like something real, but this is just what a bear market rally looks like. It doesn't go down in a straight line. You get the short covering rallies. You get, you know, people getting hopeful again that the bottom is in. And that's why on the days where you get the rallies, it's the stocks, the worst stocks that go up the most. The biggest winners today were the biggest losers over the last, few months. It's the financials, the home builders. I mean, why would anybody buy a home builder? You know, I mean, they're going down. They're going up practically nothing. The only person who would buy a home builder is somebody who was short and was covering. And that's what's going on. You got short covering going on, and it won't last, and the stocks are going to go down again.
How would you respond to Jim Cramer said today that he says he's comparing today with what happened, I guess, about back in 1990 or something. Citigroup was failing, and the Arab guy came in and bought him out, and he said that turned him around, and he says that's exactly what we have now.
No, I don't think it's exactly what we have now, because I think Citigroup is in a lot more worse shape than Citicorp was way back then. And so there's a lot more problems, there's a lot more write-downs, the losses are going to be huge. We're just scratching the surface. They're going to need a lot more capital infusion just to stay solvent before this thing is over. Maybe they'll get it, maybe they won't. But no, it's nothing like it was then.
So you're not going to the grocery store this weekend with Ben Stein and going through the cereal boxes?
Oh, is he counting those stocks again? Looking for them in cereal boxes.
I'm just kidding you.
Yeah, his favorite, Merrill Lynch, was up big again today, too. Of course, it's still way, way below where he was so heavily in it. I mean, I think he liked it. It was up in the 70s. And, you know, now it's about $20 lower than that.
Countrywide.
Even with today's 9% rally. 9% today. And, you know, the interesting thing about today's rally, the catalyst for today's rally, was a statement by the deputy governor of the Federal Reserve. Basically, what he said was the economy is worse than they thought.
Yeah.
And the market rallied on that. Now, I mean, think about that for a second. They admitted that they were wrong, that they were too optimistic, that things are worse than what they believed. So, number one, they're admitting that they didn't know what they were doing. They got their forecast wrong. Well, why is that good news? An admission by the Fed that these guys are clueless as what's going on? And then number two, look what they admitted. The economy is worse than they thought. Well, isn't that a negative? Isn't a weak economy? If the economy is worse than the Fed thought, why would stocks go up? Again, the only reason they went up is because now everybody is convinced, yes, there's going to be another rate cut. And the stocks rose on the rate cut. Like, the rate cut is actually going to do anything. It's not going to do anything. But, you know, I said last week that that a rate cut should be a sure thing right now, based on the bogus statement that the Fed put out where they claim that inflation is going to be contained below 2% for the next 3 years. The minute they said that, you knew they were going to cut rates, because that's the foundation. They can only cut rates if there's no inflation. So if they want to cut rates, they have to pretend there's no inflation to try to have the pretense of some kind of credibility. Although why anybody believes such a nonsense lie is beyond me. But that's what they have to do. They can't say inflation is going to get worse and we're going to cut rates anyway. So if they want to cut rates, the first thing they have to do is let everybody know that they're not worried about inflation because they've got it well contained. Because if inflation was a problem, they wouldn't be cutting rates. So they have to lie about it to justify the rate cut. So I don't know why the market wasn't more in tune with that last week, but somehow today's statement got everybody going.
Do you think we'll get a big rally in the U.S. stocks between now and year-end to make up the 10% they've lost?
I don't know. I doubt. I think it's more likely they go down another 10%. But even if the U.S. stock market does rally, it's going to be in the context of a weaker dollar and rising gold and commodity prices. So even if the market goes up, anybody who owns U.S. stocks is going to fall further behind. I mean, there's no way to make money in U.S. assets. You got to get out and you got to get your money abroad. Well, anyway, thanks for the call.
Bye now.
Let me take another quick commercial and we'll come back for the last segment.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, I am back, and let me quickly go back to the phones. I think, is it Mike next up in Delaware?
It is I.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Good, how are you, Peter?
Good.
Big fan.
Thank you.
Well, I want to lay something out for you. I think Wall Street's under the impression also with this Abu Dhabi thing that they're going to be the guys with the white hats riding in on camels, and they're going to take all the money and liquefy everything. But I'm looking at this. They take a major position in Citibank. After who was the prince that took a big position in that?
That was that Prince Waliers. I forget the guy's name, but that was, you know, the past caller mentioned him. That was years ago. He bought into Citibank, you know, before some of these mergers, and they became Citigroup.
Okay, but he still has a fairly large position, does he not?
Yes, he's now the second largest shareholder beyond the Abu Dhabis.
Okay, my question is, if Wall Street's under the impression and they think that these guys are going to come in and wherever there's a problem, instead of relying on the feds but rely on these guys, don't you think it's in their best interest, since they've taken a position in a pretty large money center, it's not in their best interest to help the other guys out? Because it will lessen their strength and their position. Why not let the rest of them collapse? And then if they really want to come in and buy other banks, they can do so and do it for pennies on the dollar.
Well, that's what I said. I think that if they really want to buy our banks, they should just take a step back and let them fail. But, you know, Abu Dhabi, you know, they only bought 7.5%. They bought it to preferred with 11% coupon. But if they really want to buy the bank, you know, they still want the stock to go down. And remember, they can probably put the screws on Citi because, you know, there's an obligation to make these payments of the coupon. And if they can't pay it, who knows, you know, what they might be able to force them into. But, I mean, they ultimately, by buying the preferred, they are senior to every single common shareholder. So it's possible that all the common shareholders could get wiped out, and Citigroup can end up, Abu Dhabi can end up owning the entire company based on their 7.5% stake.
Right, and the other thing, I guess,
based on their inability to make interest payments.
And they also said that I think that everybody has been talking the happy talk, like you call them the bubble vision, saying that, well, the economy's fine because there hasn't been any large layoffs. And I think that's the first thing that's coming for, and I'll get off the phone, that's the next thing that's coming for Citicorp or Citibank. But also, I'd like to hear your commentary on Countrywide, because what do they employ, 45 or 55,000 people? And then I'll get off the phone and I'll let you finish. I thank you for your time. You're a wonderful American. I love your show. Every time you're on Saturday morning with Poplava, I get up in the morning and that's the first segment I go to. I can't wait to hear you guys.
Great. Have you read my book yet?
I've read your book, and I'm actually a coin and bullion dealer down here in Delaware, and I've given more books out than I know I can count.
Yeah, you ought to have a bunch of them on your shelves there, and you know.
I just hand them to people. I say, here, I don't sell them. I just hand them to them. I think we're in a position now where it's just not about making money, and it's about people that you know about and people that you care. It's a way to survive, and they have to wake up.
Exactly, exactly.
So,
thanks a lot for your support, and keep selling those coins.
I sure will. Have a great
night.
Yeah,
the layoffs. I mean, the layoffs are going to be huge in the mortgage industry and in the real estate industry. But you know, a lot of what's happening in the real estate industry, a lot of people who are realtors, you know, they're not laid off. You know, they're independent contractors. They don't get fired. They have their licenses. So you have a lot of realtors who aren't making any money anymore, but they don't count as being unemployed. But, you know, they're still independent contractors. Maybe they used to make 50 or 100,000 a year. Now they make nothing because no one's buying any home. So you've certainly got a lot of underemployed people out there that are not getting picked up in these government surveys. And, you know, I know that, you know, recently there, you know, Walmart opened up a couple of stores, and, you know, the number of job applications, you know, in, you know, I forget what they, it's just incredible, you know, 50,000. I mean, the number of people who are applying for jobs at Walmart is astonishing. Now, if we have so few unemployed people, why is Walmart, with their low wages, you know, and lack of benefits, whatever, you know, everybody accuses them of, why are there so many people applying for every Walmart position if everybody's got a job? So, you know, I question any of these numbers that come out of Washington. You know, I don't know why everybody else is so quick to take these like they just were delivered, you know, on Sinai from God to Moses. You know, these are politicians, you know, and they certainly have an agenda. And we know these guys lie to get into office. I mean, everything they say is a lie to get elected. What makes us think they become Boy Scouts just because they're in office and they're preparing statistics? So, you know, I just don't believe them. And I don't know if it's because people are deliberately lying when they calculate them, but I just think the way they do it, the methodology, the way they go about counting who's employed and who's not employed, or what prices are going up and what prices aren't going down, these things have been redesigned over the years to present a much rosier picture of the economy than is actually warranted. And, of course, that's what politicians want, right? Politicians want us thinking everything is great. If we think the economy is good, maybe we'll return them to office. You know, so they found a great way, you know, I mean, in the olden days, right, you call it propaganda. But, I mean, this is really what the government is involved in with these economic statistics, you know. And we accuse the Chinese government of putting out phony statistics. We say, oh, their numbers are phony. You know, the government is just putting them out for the people to make them look good. Well, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, if, you know, our politicians are accusing their politicians of putting out phony numbers, why can't we be doing it? What, you have to be a Chinese? Chinese have to do it? And you think the Chinese have less reason to do it? They don't have to worry about re-election, right? These guys are in for life, right? They're communists. They don't have to stand for re-election. You know, I think American politicians are the ones that have more incentives to put out phony numbers because their jobs depend on it. Anyway, let me go. I think it's Steve in Atlanta. Steve, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, here's my question.
And no more calls, too. I think I got two more calls after Steve, and that'll be it for the night. So nobody should call in. I don't think we'll get to any more.
Okay, so I've been listening to you on and off for about 6 months now, and I definitely, you know, wish I would have gone with you 6 months ago. Now, you know, I'm looking at, you know, paying about $7,000 in capital gains once I sell my American Mutual Fund, you know, and then 3% commission. And, you know, once I get dividends and capital gains later on, will I still have to pay another 3% to reinvest? How does that work?
Well, I mean, first of all, at least you got low capital gains right now. You can pay 15%. Who knows what it's going to be next year? So take advantage of the low capital gains. But, you know, when you buy stocks with me, the idea is to buy them and hold them and never sell them. I mean, I can't help it if Abu Dhabi comes in and you know, we have like five or six stocks in this year that have been taken over for cash by sovereign wealth funds. And so, but that's not the plan when we buy them. The plan is to buy these stocks and keep them and collect the dividends. So you pay a commission to me and don't expect to pay me a lot more money unless you invest more money. But on that initial money, we're going to, you know, try to buy you stocks that your grandchildren can own. The whole idea is to buy them so you can buy into an income stream and get your wealth out of the dollar. And don't think about, you know, what you're going to spend in taxes and fees, because it's nothing compared to what you're going to lose if you stay where you are. That's the real wealth. You know, I mean, people are going to lose a fortune in U.S. dollar-denominated assets. You've got to think about protecting your purchasing power. And if you pay a little taxes and you pay some commission to me to protect your purchasing power, believe me, it's well worth it. And it's not too late. You know, you didn't do it 6 months ago, fine. You know, don't make that mistake again. Don't call me up 6 months from now and say, gee, I should have went with you, you know, a year ago. You know, just, you know, you just make the decision, get your financial house in order, get your assets out of dollars, and, okay, you know, and you can sleep soundly. You'll be in better shape.
So when your brokers choose from their stocks that you certify, do they try to buy on dips, you know, when stocks are on?
No, we're not trying to time the market. I mean, unless you ask them to and you ask them to put a limit in. I mean, in general, on any given day, nobody knows for sure if the stock's going to go up or down. So my philosophy is, look, get rid of your dollars as fast as you can. Don't try to be a hero. Don't try to save a couple of percent by trying to time the market. You're just as likely to get it wrong as get it right. So just get rid of your dollars on any given day. There's more risk that the dollar goes down than anything else. And I just say, you know, you get rid of it. If we were day trading, if we were trying to trade the money, then it would be important. But when we're buying these stocks to hold them for the long run, you know, trying to save a percent or two by trying to time it when we could just as likely end up missing it, and you end up paying a couple of percent more. So I just put the money to work as soon as we get it, and then be done with it. We don't, you know, and we've got a lot of clients that we don't need to spend that much time, you know, trying to finesse this when there's no guarantee we're going to do it successfully. I mean, we're not, you know, we don't have a crystal ball on the movements in the stock market.
Sure. So would you recommend that I stick all of what I'm worth, you know, from that mutual fund with you?
Well, I don't know. You got to have this conversation with one of the brokers, and you make a decision on your own based on, you know what you think. I mean, you have to, it's your money. You've got to decide, you know, what you're comfortable with. You have to understand, personally, me, you know, with what I believe, I don't want any of my money in the dollar. I just think it's too risky. Other people might have a different conclusion. You just have to, you weigh the facts on your own, and you decide where you think the risks are, how much of your wealth you want to have in the U.S., and how much you want to have abroad. But one of the things I think is important that people forget, and I got to hurry because I got two more calls on hold, is a lot of us, you know, our livelihoods are already tied to the dollar. You know, we have jobs. We get paid dollars. We have pensions in dollars. We have Social Security that we think we're going to get in dollars. So people are already heavily invested in dollars. Given that, it makes sense to take whatever money that they have actually control and invest that money foreign to offset all the risks that are beyond their control that are totally tied to the dollar.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks for the call. Let me quickly we lost the chat. Okay, great. We just have Bill from Colorado, so you could be the last caller. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Peter. Thanks again for taking my call. I've read your book. I've been investing in line with your recommendations since I read the book back in February, and it's been pretty successful overall. I'm at the point where I'm about to, I think, go ahead and open an account with you guys. And I just had a different question. It's kind of offbeat, but it might be more practical for most Americans, you know, maybe Americans that aren't in the investor class. And my question would be, you know, I'm looking at all the things you've said, and looking at one of the most logical ramifications of it is going to be increasing, you know, gasoline costs. And if you had the choice between an investment, you know, where a person puts money, say, in gold or with you, or, you know, anything that's international versus investing in, say, you know, a high-level fuel economy car like a Prius or a Jetta TDI or something like that, what would you recommend?
Well, I don't think buying a car is an investment. I mean, it's
true
for good. But I mean, if you want to pay a little bit more to buy a car that is more fuel efficient, you can say, okay, you know, I mean, I think it makes sense. I mean, you have to look at the cost of a Prius versus another car that might be less expensive that that requires more gas. But I've always said, you know, if you're worried about high gas prices, you know, I love, you know, making these energy investments. And right now, these Canadian trusts, a lot of these oil and gas trusts, again, continue to get pounded. And I've been buying more of these things myself. And I think they're just a great buy. And they pay monthly dividends. And my philosophy is, you know, when it comes to oil, you know, don't get mad. Get in on it. You know, own this stuff. You know, have more of your income tied to the price of oil and gas so that you're happy when you go to the tank. And it's the higher the price, the better, because you own this stuff. You're getting paid income on the stuff. And, you know, right now, you might not notice that. I mean, oil prices are up, but a lot of these Canadian gas trusts, oil and gas trusts, are down. I think this is a fluke. I think it's a great buying opportunity. A couple of years from now, people are going to be very glad that they bought these stocks. And they're not going to worry at all about how much it costs to fill up their car and heat their house, because they're going to have a lot of cash flow to pay those bills.
True, true. Okay, I agree. A car is not an investment. I guess I'm looking at it from the standpoint of, if you have to have a car anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at the cost. I mean, you know, a lot of these fuel-efficient cars are more expensive. I don't know. I mean, I don't shop. I haven't priced them. And, you know, the cost of gasoline is not that important to me, because it's a small component of my income, and I don't really think about it. But for people who are really cost-conscious, if they drive a lot — I don't drive too much every day. My office is not too far from my house. And so if you drive a lot and, you know, you spend a lot of money, then you can, you know, you can consider it an investment in a way, if, you know, you can see a return on it in savings over the long run. I mean, I remember watching this TV show with they were making fun of him, but I thought it was a shrewd investment. This this guy, Larry Hagman, right, who used to be on Dallas and Jeannie, and he had spent, I forget how much it was, you know, a couple $100,000. You know, solar heating is a 20,000 square foot castle he lives in, or whatever it was. And they were making fun of him. But when he told me that he got a tax credit, and so half of it reduced his taxes, and when he told me how much money he was saving on electricity every year, how much his bill went down, I said, you know what, that was a shrewd investment. His payback period was very short. They were making fun of him. But based on what the tax credit he got and how much he was saving every year, based on what he had to outlay, I thought he was a very good investment, the money he spent on making his place fuel efficient.
Right, right. Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much. I don't need to take any more of your time.
Well, great, because we're running out of time. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, sir. Good night.
Anyway, thank again everybody for listening and calling up, and I know we're getting some more listeners now, because I don't really have to ask for the callers. I think I gave out the number one time, and the board was full the whole time. And I thank everybody again who put reviews up on my book, Crash Proof. If you haven't written one up, go to Amazon.com and type in a review. I noticed there are no reviews on Barnes & Noble. There's one 5-star review on Barnes & Noble. So maybe if somebody wants to go over there to BarnesandNoble.com and put up a review, because there's only one. At least it's a 5-star review, but I kind of feel bad that there's only one review on Barnes & Noble, and we've got 102 reviews on Amazon. But the more the better. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. I will be back again next week, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Don't forget the website, www.europac.net, and buy the book Crash Proof for your friends for Christmas. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next week.